The DeFalco Files is an entertainment-based program. Some memories of certain events might be fuzzy. All opinions are that of the host. Content might not be appropriate for children and some adults. Listener discretion is advised. And remember, the truth is here. Vegas Bad Boys of Podcasting presents The DeFalco Files with FSW owner Joe DeFalco and your host, Matt Michaels.
Hey everybody, welcome to The DeFalco Files. I'm Matt Michaels with the star of this show, FSW's creator and the Vince McMahon of Las Vegas, Mr. Joe DeFalco. How you doing, Joe?
I'm doing great, except I have like one millionth of the money that Vince McMahon has.
Well, you know, would you consider Joey to be the Shane McMahon of Las Vegas?
No, he would be the Bob McMahon.
Well, you know, as long as you don't have an Ed McMahon, then we're all right.
We're so far so good.
So last week's episode did really well. I think people were really happy with getting to hear about the beginnings of Future Stars of Wrestling. One quick follow-up that we did have that we didn't cover last week, and some listeners were wondering, how did you actually come up with the name Future Stars of Wrestling?
I'm pretty sure when I was banding about what we were looking to do, we wanted to create something to where people, when they, you know, you could call yourself Vegas Championship Wrestling, you can call yourself Nevada Championship Wrestling, whatever you want to do. But I felt with the name Future Stars of Wrestling, you know, it's tough enough being an independent wrestling company trying to get fans. And I know there was a lot of people that weren't very excited about the name. You know, Mike Modest, who was our first main trainer, you know, he was like, well, if you say they're future stars of wrestling, it means they're not stars. Mm-hmm. And why is anybody going to give a shit? Well, fortunately for us, the Reno Scum, the Sean Rickers, the Brian Cages, it started to solidify us, and we try to go more with the name FSW,
right,
instead of Future Stars of Wrestling, because number one, I didn't want to be pigeonholed as a small Vegas company.
Right.
And obviously we weren't going to be Ring of Honor or, you know, any of these major companies at that time, but we wanted to be able to break out if we did go elsewhere, if we did do shows with the name Vegas Championship Wrestling, and then you go to Phoenix, Arizona, it would, to the fans, maybe they're not supporting a local company, they're supporting an outside company.
Yeah.
So in turn, it's kind of twofold. I was looking for a name that would differentiate us from being just another one of a million local city promotions that are all over the United States. And a name that would be catchy enough that, you know, hopefully when you turn on Future Stars of Wrestling, you're not watching two guys that are the shits. Because the thing is, when we went on television very early, and it's first impressions. So if you decide, hey, FSW is on the CW, they said Future Stars of Wrestling, and you turned it on and the first match was garbage, guess what? You're probably not watching again anyway, so it doesn't really matter what the name is.
Right.
So, but by doing the show, and before TV, we did the live events, of course, because we had to get the footage. But when we were Future Stars of Wrestling, and then all of a sudden people see really good talent, and then when we did our first shows, whether it was Disco Inferno or Jimmy Superfly Snuka or The Godfather or Deuce, you know, or Kenny King even – you knew there was some talented people there, and hopefully, as we said, you're coming to the show to see a future star of wrestling. And, you know, in the first couple of main shows we ever did, we did have the Reno Scum and Brian Cage and Sean Ricker. You know, it was funny because I was scrolling down. I went through the emails and I saw, you know, the first email that Ricker ever sent me in 2011, introduced himself. And I told him, hey, this is what's going on. Best we could do is get you $50. I'd love to have you come out. And from there on, it was like, you know, we knew immediately that that guy was going to be a future star of wrestling.
Excellent.
And the name, basically, we think fit, especially since we've had so much. Now the name, looking back, is, wow, what a great name. Because look at all the guys that have come through, future stars of wrestling, and our fan base can say, man, we saw Kevin Cross before he made it. We saw Chris Bay. We saw Sean Ricker. We saw Brian Cage. We saw Hammerstone. We saw Douglas James. We saw the Rito Scum. And then not only those guys, but there's so many other guys that are a mainstay on the independent wrestling, you know, companies. And of course, Kenny King was a known guy, but he's kind of the mainstay of Las Vegas wrestling. He's a guy who grew up as a Las Vegas wrestler because of Tough Enough. So, you know, that's where the name, you know, kind of fit. Like I said, people were like, oh, that's a terrible name. It, you know, people are going to be like, well, if you're not a star, why would I want to watch somebody who's not a star? And I understood that, but I just felt the good outweighed the bad with the name. And I think 11 years later, I was proven correct once again.
Absolutely. It makes total sense. And it really is a good name in terms of the fact that you were able to just associate it from Future Stars Wrestling to FSW. And it, you know, has that kind of feel of almost like ECW in a sense, where, you know, it went from Eastern Championship Wrestling to Extreme Championship Wrestling to just ECW. And the fans are absolutely chomping at the bit here at FSW to get some wrestling rolling again. So in the meantime, we get to talk a little bit about the history of the championship belt, which we'll hopefully see defended here someday soon once this quarantine gets lifted. So as we start into the championship history, when you came up with the beginning of FSW, you guys make this company. How long in the planning process did it take you to go from, okay, this is our idea, to actually crowning the first champion?
It was immediate. When I found out that Las Vegas or the state of Nevada deregulated wrestling, it made it so much of an easier process. Before, you know, if you ran smaller shows, you're going to get gouged by having a two paramedics, an ambulance, the athletic commission. You know, you're $2,000-$3,000 out the door before you even think of getting a venue, getting talent. You know, wow, now at that point you could draw 200-300 people and still lose your ass.
Right.
So when they deregulated wrestling, you know, that $2,500 charge is off the books. So now you're going to negotiate. Like I said, we found the Rancho Swap Meet. I would say from the day that I decided I wanted to go forward with FSW, I think we did a show probably within 3 or 4 months. Because wow. I remember talking about it at the CAC, which was in 2009, and we did the show Memorial Day weekend in May. So, wow. If the CAC was in March or early April, we had probably just over a month or so set it up, and then we went to the CAC shows, you know, for the convention,
right?
And we were moving forward then. So, again, I'm going to say 3 to 4 months from the concept to we're going to do the first show. I had to, talk to some people, as I said before. We were involved in a little company called Vegas Extreme that we did out of Rush's wrestling school, where the guys we brought in were tremendous talent. We had Mike Knox and Derek Nykirk and Snuka Jr. and Bison Smith and Ace Steele. And you know, Gallo and Navajo Warrior. And we had a good crew of guys from Arizona, through other connection with Mike Modest. That's how we got Bison Smith. Connection we had with a guy, Pete, in Chicago. You came from there, was working with us, and he was buddies with Ace Steele, and Ace liked Bison a lot, so he kind of flew himself in to work some of these little tapings. And later on down the line, the Riggs brothers and Funny Bone, and a lot of these guys, you know, for the 8 to 10 guys that we focused on, most of them ended up getting signed there too.
Yeah.
And so once we were putting together the show on Memorial Day weekend, we're going to crown a champion. We don't have a belt. We don't have a ring. Legacy, who worked with us for many years, he had a small company that he was getting where he had a school, VCW, Vegas Championship Wrestling. So we were kind of first out of the box. And he decided he was going to run some stuff. So we ended up working together. So he let us use the ring. In exchange, he wanted his youngsters to get a match. So they got the opening match on the show. And Sugar Brown, who was then known as Tommy Danger, he was on the card. We had the Young Bucks, as I stated, Brandon Cutler, some other SoCal guys, because we were running in a predominantly Mexican area. We did it at the Rancho Swap Meet, and we ended up bringing in some guys. There was a guy named Chimera, who later became the manager for Del Rio. I forgot his name.
Ricardo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a few of those guys, and there was a company out of SoCal that was running. And when the owners of the company, they were a tag team, we didn't have a spot for them. So they decided that they were going to now run the same day as us.
Oh.
So,
oh, oh.
Ricardo and SoCal Crazy and a few of the others bailed on us like a week before the show or 2 weeks before the show. Even Ryan Taylor we had booked on the first show, and he decided to stay in SoCal. Huh. So, but we had built a strong fan base, not fan base, a roster base. You know, I was always online trying to find the best talent. And we decided to do an 8-man tournament that night. I'm pretty sure we used the VCW title. Or actually, we may not have. There was a guy, Donnie, who recently passed away. And Donnie had a couple of belts. He had it was called the Gorgeous George Championship Wrestling Belt. We've used it to fill in for the Mecca, and we've used it as a fill-in title, Gorgeous Belt. And that was where we were going to have the first champion crowned, was at the very first show. You know, want to do a show, you want to have a championship.
Right.
So the main focus was going to be Kenny King and Derek Nykirk. Derek was a guy who was in HWA, which was the WWF developmental in Cincinnati, Ohio. Les Thatcher was the trainer. One of our guys, Jack Slammy, who was one of our ring announcers, he decided after one of the CACs by talking to Les, and he went down to Cincinnati and hung out with the crew and ended up working there for a while. Well, Derek got released, and he was out of Phoenix, Arizona, so he didn't really know anybody. So we ended up hooking him up, because at that point we were dealing with Navajo Warrior and Gallo and Mike Knox. And we hooked him up with them. He ended up becoming best friends with Mike Knox. So when we did the tournament, Derek, you know, great heel. He also became part of Heyman Security and ECW later on, after he went back to WWF. But Derek and Kenny was the main focus, you know, on the show. And we actually had Malachi Jackson, which was the Young Bucks' brother, the younger brother. He wrestled. He was in the tournament, and Little Cholo was supposed to be there, and he didn't show up. We got to a Final Four, you know, I can't even remember everybody offhand. It was like, but I know it was Derek and Kenny down to the end. Funny Bone was supposed to be on the show, but as typical Funny Bone, he got fucked up in a match a few weeks earlier. I think he had broke his collarbone or something. And he was, you know, he ended up distracting Derek because there was some heat that we were setting up between them, and Kenny King became crowned the first ever FSW heavyweight champion in May of 2009.
What was it about Kenny that was leading you to making him that first champion? Was it, you know, his established name here in Vegas, or was it something that you also could see his work rate was good enough that it gave you a credible champion?
In 2009, Kenny really didn't have a name as a Vegas guy as in wrestling. I'm pretty sure he worked for FIP, and if he was doing any Ring of Honor by then, which he probably was, it was some smaller stuff. So he really wasn't a household name, but he was the biggest name we had. Yeah. You know, he was the one who had the credibility that he was in, you know, a secondary major company, because, you know, at that point, Ring of Honor was not as big as it was in 2009, you know, right. And they had their hardcore, but they stayed mainly on the East Coast and things like that. So we just felt Kenny would be the best representative. He was local, you know, he charged a great rate for us to have a name guy in there. You know, Derek, with the WWF pedigree that he had, you know, he was the perfect foil for, you know, Kenny down the line. And then when we were going to move the belt, you know, probably it was only going to be 4 to 6 months or whatever it was, we were going to switch it over to Derek. And then there was issues. There's rumors of them, why they didn't show. Was it legitimate? But all I know is that whole Arizona crew didn't come out to a big show at the Silver Nugget. And they let me know like the day before. They were working at a bar, claimed they had to go to Michigan. I think they're doing some Heath's bar, and they kind of worked as bodyguards for him or something like that. And then all of a sudden they couldn't make the show, and we were kind of scrambling. And at that point, we made the decision that despite him not wanting, as again, the name was Future Stars Wrestling, Mike Modest was against it, but we felt the need to, you know, make the change.
Right.
And not because we weren't happy with Kenny. It was kind of like with the roster we had, we exhausted everything he did. You know, it's nice to let's get a heel champion in there. And Modest and Nykerk were in the same faction. They were called the Elite Extremists. And it also had Gallo in there in that group. And they kind of ran roughshod. So sticking Modest in that spot was just a necessary evil to move forward. You know, now we're probably talking the midway of 2010.
So Kenny had the belt for almost a full year. I think it was
almost. Yes. Yeah. He did.
So was.
But you got to remember beforehand, you know, when we did the show in May, we didn't probably do another show till November.
Right, that's what I was just going to ask. So what was the frequency of the shows? So really, it was basically at that time, you got a champion because it's your first show, and now what you're doing is essentially building up the product through taping for TV and helping get it ready to kind of build that base, essentially.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we had TV by then. We didn't have the wrestling school until probably April or May of 2010. And like I said, for about a month or so, it was at my house in the backyard. And June of 2010 is when we actually started the FSW training facility. So we did the one show in May. We were supposed to do another one in July, had issues with the swap meet, couldn't do it anymore. Then we ended up making a deal with the Silver Nugget, so we did it in November, and then we started doing it every 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay.
So, you know, the first title defense for Kenny at the Silver Nugget was Disco Inferno. And that closed out 2009, and then, you know, 2010, we came back in January, and I'm pretty sure Kenny had a match with Derek that we had some kind of finish. So it may have been may have been March or April when we did the next show, and that's when Modest ended up taking the belt, and then we never used Nykerk again.
Wow. Now, Mike was still living in Northern California, right? He would just make the commute out here, or did he actually move here for that time period he was the champ and training and all that?
Yeah, and like I said, we didn't have the training till probably May, so Mike probably came out in March or April of 2010 as we were in the process of putting together having the school.
And at this point, Mike, for people who don't know Mike Modest, he's probably most recognizable for being in Beyond the Mat, where he was one of the two wrestlers from Roland's school that got a tryout at the WWF at that time. Mike was also really well known throughout California and throughout the West Coast, and got opportunities for like wrestling at WCW, and you know, he was making a good name for himself. And then of course
in Japan with Donovan Morgan, when they had their tag team, they were probably one of the most over American tag teams in Japan for pro wrestling Noah.
Yeah. So he is a very reputable person, and I could see where also he's really kind of Mike Modest is a good name for him, because he is kind of, you know, a modest person. I could see where he wouldn't have wanted the belt. What was the result of him having the belt, and was it something that, you know, kind of, again, it was like 250 days is around the time he had the belt. Were fans receptive and starting to, you know, because he had a baby face first and Kenny, but you didn't have too many shows. Here you get a little more shows and you have Mike, who's a really good heel. Were the fans starting to buy into it? And was that a good move, putting the belt on a heel to actually have people chasing as you're trying to build your roster?
Well, absolutely. You know, if you look back 10 years, it was probably better that Mike did have the belt than Derek. Derek lived in Phoenix.
Yeah.
Mike lived in Vegas. You know, we filmed a lot of TV, you know. And if you go back and look at some of the archives, some of the funniest promos and vignettes are Mike Modest. You know, there is no doubt, he can irritate the fuck out of you as a heel, but he would also do some outrageous stuff. You know, I remember he had a feud with Kid Vegas, and part of the feud was he lost his girlfriend for 30 days. And I remember him like being so upset about it. And he basically was drinking bleach and he was going berserk. And it's one of the funniest promos that I've seen. Then we did another one because we both worked at Cheetahs at the time, where he did a vignette with the Godfather seeking advice over, you know, losing his girl. And, you know, we were, you know, always trying to come up with ideas, and he came up with some good ones. I came up with some good ones, and his run was a really good second champion. And the reason Mike lost the championship was, I'm not sure we really had it planned for him to lose it, but we did a crazy match. And it was more of a tag match. It was with the Suburban Commandos, and it was Modest and somebody else. But it was like a four-way ladder match for the tag titles at Silver Nugget. And Mike landed wrong and fucked up his arm. I believe he broke his arm.
Ooh.
The match was atrocious. It was just like a brutal match that I don't think we ever ended up airing it on TV, because it was just so violent. Like, you know, certain things happened. I remember, I think it was Mike. He was supposed to get thrown into something and it missed and he landed on the concrete.
Oh.
And it literally was a mess. and Mike was kind of going around with a broken arm, that we decided that it was time to move the belt again. And there was a man by the name of Franco D'Angelo, and Franco used to drive up from Dallas, Texas.
Wow.
He would drive from Dallas, and again, not even probably paid as much as the gas had cost. But Franco wanted to be a part of it. He was a big guy in great shape, had a lot of charisma, and maybe we jumped the gun a little too soon, but at that point we had no choice, and he was again the best option. And it ended up being, I remember, an extremely short match because, you know, Mike could barely do anything with the arm.
Right.
And then Franco, you know, ended up winning the title.
And with Franco, how experienced was he? Because, I mean, a monster is probably the best word. He looks kind of like Brian Cage in terms of the body type.
You know, he definitely had a lot of experience. He had some tryouts with WWF before that. He had a very good name in Texas, and he was trying to expand it. He was trying to be that next breakout star. And as future stars of wrestling, here was a fresh face. You know, here was a guy who ended up making the school shows. Now, back then, we probably did a school show once a month.
Yeah.
You know, over at the Boulder Highway, but we were running more consistently. And Franco, despite the fact of all the travel, you know, he was able to get some buddy passes or whatever through knowing people. So he was able to get to Vegas a lot more inexpensively than it would normally be. And, you know, he wanted to be the face of the company. Unfortunately for Franco, he had some major, major injuries.
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, he was feuding with Alcatraz, and I believe he ended up getting, you know, after he feuded with Alcatraz, he ended up getting hurt, and then we had to have another, you know, match because the title had to be vacated because Franco was unavailable to defend.
Right, the title. And at that time, yeah, it did go vacant. After Franco got hurt, had to vacate the title. Does Franco come back into the picture in terms of coming back to FSW, or was that pretty much kind of it for him?
I'm a little clouded on the time frame, but I do remember a big match at Sam's Town, so I believe he did come back, and I believe it was that was when we were running the FSW Arizona, because it was FSW Vegas. And I believe Franco ended up making a return. I think it was Alcatraz, Franco D'Angelo, and Remy Marcel. And it was against Tyson Tyler, Johnny the Bull, and somebody else.
Wow.
And that was a big main event for us at Sam's Town. But then Franco got involved in a horrific car accident where he almost died. But it took him a very, very long time to even recover enough to live his life.
Wow.
You know? And, you know, we had talked a few times about him coming back, but he had some setbacks. And then, you know, that pretty much kind of ended his run in FSW.
And when the title goes vacant, did you hold another tournament? Because eventually the title would, in, I think it's July of 2011, Alcatraz wins the first of two title reigns for himself.
Yes, we did a four-way elimination match.
Okay.
We weren't going to go through the whole tournament. It was Funny Bone. It was Alcatraz. It was Mike Modest. And the fourth name escapes me. And Modest and Alcatraz were basically a faction together, and Modest tried to double cross Alcatraz at the end, and Alcatraz overcame and basically became a babyface. And and Alcatraz was now our champion, and he was now a babyface champion, which was kind of crazy. Here was this badass dude wearing the orange jumpsuit, and he was part of I don't know if they were called the Vegas Wrecking Crew or something like that. And they became associates of Mike Modest. But Mike Modest was known to bully his his guys. And Alcatraz ended up turning on Mike. And that was how Alcatraz won his first FSW Heavyweight Championship.
How familiar were the fans at that point with Alcatraz before you put the title on him?
Oh, pretty well. It's funny, the story of Alcatraz. Back in the day when we did the first show at the swap meet, MySpace was popular. And I remember hitting him up. And he was lukewarm about coming back. He had moved from SoCal, where he was a legend. You know, that right. guy was one of the biggest stars in SoCal wrestling.
Yep.
And he was kind of taking it easy, you know, working in the nightclubs, whatever, bouncing, kind of content with what was going on. So time had passed. Me and my son, we were at the Thomas and Mack. And as usual, I was there with thousands of flyers trying to get the word out about FSW. And as I'm walking with my kid, I'm like, hey, Joey, that guy over there, pretty sure that's Alcatraz. So me being the people person that I am, you know, I walked over to him. And then we started talking for 30 or 40 minutes. And I got him interested and excited about being a part of what we were trying to do. And we weren't just some fly-by-night rinky-dink company, which a lot of independent companies are, run a couple shows, disappear, never to be seen or heard from again. You know, I had a long-term plan. He liked it. And that's how we got Alcatraz back in the mix. And, you know, he had a second career in Las Vegas that, you know, really ended his wrestling career on a high note.
Yeah. It's really cool that you have him in the lineage, because he, like you said, he is definitely a legend in California. And with someone like that, at that point, the opponents that you were giving him, were some of the younger guys getting a chance to work with a veteran like that? Was that part of the reasoning of him having the title?
Again, it wasn't really the reasoning, because, you know, you can't plan things out for a couple of years, because as you just saw, you know, three different times a champion was ending up being different than what was an expecting to be.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't expect, you know, did we expect Alcatraz? He's already been feuding with Franco, so he'd been in the mix for a while. But at that point, he wasn't really full time, and I'm not sure he was even in a thought other than for somebody to put over Franco.
Right.
And once we got him and he became the champion, well, now he became a more regular with FSW. He became one of the guys.
Yeah.
And that's always the thing. Like, it took Brian Cage a long time to get into the mix in FSW, because I'd use him here, I'd use him there. You know, you'd see him, then you didn't see him for a few months. You know, the fans in Las Vegas, they get behind who they feel are locals. And by meaning locals, it's people who work the company all the time. Hammerstone, Graves, Ricker, Cage, they became locals. I didn't differentiate them because they drove in from California. Reno Scum, you know, we always joke that, you know, they're the only guys from Reno that anybody in Las Vegas likes. You know? Because no matter what they did, they were always beloved, you know, by our fans.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Alcatraz, and there was a guy like Funny Bone who was always on the cusp and, you know, missed out on winning this title, missed out on winning that title. And then at the time, there was a gentleman who also became a heavyweight champion. His name was Tyshawn. And Tyshawn's name, he was working for the local company AU that would run once a year, basically, over at the Extreme thing. And Kid Vegas knew some of the guys who ended up later being Tommy Misfit, who became Thomas Day, and a few other guys. They worked one of our Silver Nugget shows. I had called Tyshawn. He had some kind of crappy gimmick, Titan or whatever it was, a robotic. It was horrible. Okay, so we had called him up, and I had pitched him an idea, which was a brilliant idea, of course. We were putting together the Splat Pack. And the Splat Pack was going to consist of Mean Martin, Tang Sumatra, because it was one of the Samoan guys we knew, Reno Tafuli. Jason Partain was going to be Mean Martin, and Tyshawn was going to come in as Slammy Davis Jr. Okay? I still think it's one of my greatest creations. It still will be a part of it. We tried doing it at the Freak Show. We used Shogun as it. But the Splat Pack, I thought, was a brilliant idea. It's Vegas. It's entertainment. If we ever do, like, bar shows or things like that, kind of like we've done with Santana Jackson, the Splat Pack will be resurrected for sure. Okay? So now we get ready to do the show, and it's like, hey, you know, where's Slammy? And, you know, he never showed up. Never heard from him, you know, for a while. You know, I got word that the other guy said he wouldn't use him anymore, blah, blah, blah. There was a lot of animosity. We ran shows. They didn't. He felt, you know, a lot of bad talk about us. Oh, Joe don't pay the guys. He only pays the star guys that he comes in. And like the Godfather, and it's like, well, if that's the case, I'm pretty sure I'd be found in the desert if I kept stiffing the Reno scum and they still kept coming out, because at the time they were driving from Reno for $50.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always told people, I'm not going to pay you the best. I'm going to pay you what I can. And if you want to be a part of it, fantastic. But a lot of people on the West Coast, especially California, when you wrestle in front of 50, 60 people all the time, you get to come to Vegas. I get your room for the night. And you're wrestling in front of 300, 400 people. You know, this was a fun place to come. It was a different territory for people. So probably about 6 or 8 months after everything went down, Jason Cash, Jay Cash, he came in to talk to me. I guess they were tired of what was going on over there. And he was kind of, he came down with Tyshawn. And we talked about training, and obviously they had training, so it was going to be a lower rate. And Jay Cash says, you know, just put it on my bill. You know, I'll pay for Tyshawn. You know, I want to get down here. And we brought Tyshawn into the mix. And we had him thump, you know, guys. He just came in as a killer.
Yeah.
And he was a killer, you know, 6'6", 375 pounds, and he was a monster. And we taught him to be a monster. You know, where he used to wrestle, they kind of made everybody wrestle the same. So despite he had a 200-pound weight advantage on somebody, you know, it was back and forth, and it didn't make him special.
Right.
You know, we felt the need to make him special. And I remember there was people there like, oh, you know, you got to teach this guy a lesson. You know, he came over from AU. You know, we got to humble him. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm going to have him come in and job out to Kid Vegas, and then I'm going to make him a star. It's like, that's not how it works. It's called first impressions. This guy is a monster. He's doing the right things, and we're going to push him to the moon because he's deserving of it. And we did it, and finally we set it up where Alcatraz was now going to defend against Tyshawn Prince. It was a big show at our FSW Arena, the original one, and we set it up. Tyshawn is undefeated. He's thumped everybody he's worked, and him and Alcatraz, they did a top rope move where it ended up being a double pin, and it worked out brilliantly. There was a lot of animosity, a lot of heat going on. Sally was Tyshawn's manager. and that set the stage. Because of the double pin, we were able to have our very first no escape. And it was the steel cage match at Sam's Town, which to this day is one of the top two or three attended shows that we've ever had. But that was the night that really made FSW was the steel cage match. Like, it took us to a totally another level. And, you know, believe me, it was a brutal match. Tyshawn basically Baldo bombed Alcatraz from the top rope, punctured a lung, rib, whatever it was. But Alcatraz got fucked up, and Tyshawn won, and you know, it was the crowning of a new champion. That was, you know, the true future star of wrestling, you know, winning the title, to where it was, we may not have trained him originally. And he had good training, and he was pretty good, but we really took him and helped him get to the next level, as well as himself working hard, and he was the most deserving guy and deserved, you know, everything he got by becoming the heavyweight champion. And then I remember, you know, he had some defenses. We had another big show at Sam's Town, and we had to think of another gimmick match, so we ended up doing a casket match. And I'll always remember this part of the story. You know, a lot of people say it was a receipt because of what happened in the first match. And believe me, Al loves Tyshawn, had a lot of great respect for him, but I guess he felt the receipt was needed. I've never got it confirmed or denied, but Alcatraz brought out a fire extinguisher, and he lit up Tyshawn with that fire extinguisher that I always look at the Pillsbury Doughboy. Because Tyshawn from head to toe was covered with the shit from the fire extinguisher. And I always thought, man, you know, that match wasn't that great a match. But boy, I remember watching it later. I'm like, man, this was a great match also. And beating the champion in a rematch, you know, that solidified Tyshawn as the man in FSW. And then the question becomes, because whenever we crown a champion, it's like, all right, so who are we looking for next?
Right.
And at that point, you know, he exhausted all the baby faces. There was really nothing left on the table. And it was like, you know, Tyshawn had been holding the belt for an extremely long time. And it was like, okay, so where do we go from here? Well, at that point, Sean Ricker was a guy that would walk into the arena. Everybody would be in hushed silence because he had the best promo of anybody we had heard. And he'd come out, and people would be enamored in everything he would say. Then he'd go wrestle a match, and he'd probably wrestle a babyface, and Sean Ricker would then get booed. But they wouldn't boo him when he was talking. A lot of times when the heel wants to talk, they want to boo him because they don't like him. Right. They liked him, but they didn't like him. But they knew the talent was there. He was a guy that we're like, man, here's a guy we know is going to the Fed, and we know he's going soon. So finally, Sean Ricker cuts a promo, and he cuts it on Sally and Tyshawn Prince. And now the crowd is like, oh, yeah, we love this guy. Because now here's a guy that people believe could take out the Giant.
Yeah.
You know, he's the unstoppable force. So we set up the match at the Silverton, Sean Ricker versus Tyshawn Prince. Oh, this is one for the ages. Sean Ricker comes in and he says, hey, Joe, I need to talk to you. I'm like, okay, bro, what's up? He's like, I'm signing with WWE.
Oh.
I'm like, oh, shit, really? I'm like, well, when? He's like, yeah, I have to go in like a month. Ooh. And, of course, the idea is we're putting the belt on Sean Ricker tonight. And Ooh. It's like, fuck. We're going to do all this buildup and all this stuff, and then Tyshawn beats him. Where do we go? So, you know, we stay the course. You know, Remy Marcel gets involved. He ends up clobbering Tyshawn Prince. Sean Ricker hits the gravy train. 1, 2, 3, new champion. The crowd erupts. Boom. This is awesome. The Reign of Sean Ricker. So we have a school show in 2 weeks. What happens? Sean Ricker's got to drop the title. So we set up something with Remy Marcel, and that's how Remy in FSW lore is the only person to hold every championship in FSW. And we do the match. Sally gets involved. Never forget that. Ricker grabs Sally and throws him toward the rope. Sally misses the rope. And, of course, he lands headfirst on the concrete. Sally's in Never Never Land. I remember the referee getting back. The finish was clunky as clunky can be. But Remy Marcel now becomes the FSW heavyweight champion.
Wow.
And it was like, so he held the belt, Ricker, for probably 3 weeks.
Wow.
And at that point, Remy Marcel has the belt. But now he has to wrestle Tyshawn Prince at the next casino show, and Tyshawn regains the title. So Remy's probably the shortest reigning heavyweight champion in FSW history. He held the belt for 2 weeks, and then the belt got put back on Tyshawn Prince.
Wow. It's, you know, very interesting that Ricker's contract with the WWE, you knew he was going to get signed. And of course, the minute you go to put the belt on him, they do sign him, which is great, because the coolest thing about what you're able to do that I think fans really enjoy is that when you have something like that fall in your lap, it's not looked at by you as a problem. It's looked at as, here's the solution. And that gives fans a totally, you know, kind of that feel of anything can happen. And you're seeing that in a period of about a month, month and a half, you've got the title going through, you know, three people, which we haven't seen. And they're legitimately great workers in Ricker and Remy. With Tyshawn, was Tyshawn someone who the fans just gravitated to hating him? Or was some of that also helped by the fact that he had Sal to kind of help garner the heat? Because Sal is a heat magnet. He's so good at what he does.
Well, how could you like the guy? He was beating up your favorite wrestler. Sally was basically, you know, saying negative things about your favorite wrestler. And then they would go out and they would take care of business.
Yeah.
So the respect is always there. You know, quick Tyshawn story being, you know, his last name, you know, we're like, you know, we had to come up with a name for him. And there was Tyshawn. There was Tayshaun Prince, who was a basketball player.
Right.
And that's how I gave Tyshawn his name. I gave him his name. I'm like, be Tyshawn Prince, because we had a king. So if we had a king, now we can have a prince, which down the line became the royal court when they did become a tag team. So that was already in the back of my head, thinking that would be a perfect name to use for Tyshawn. I wanted to throw that in there too. So.
And speaking of him, I just got to ask you about this match that happened in that first reign, and that was he actually gets a chance to wrestle Kevin Nash.
Yes. The prelim to the Mecca, Lady Chrissy, who we worked with at Sam's Town. It's funny, it's weird that I brought up Kid Vegas's name four times already. But Kid Vegas's dad was friends with Chrissy, and Chrissy ran the entertainment department in Sam's Town. So they invited Chrissy to come to one of our school shows. And, you know, as per usual, there was a couple hundred people at a small school show in some little shopping mart on Boulder Highway. So we had talked to her, and she was the catalyst, and she got us in at Sam's Town at the crazy, unrealistic price of absolutely nothing.
Wow.
We didn't pay for the room when Chrissy was in charge. And, of course, that's changed. But we had a free room, which was amazing, because at the Silver Nugget, we were paying anywhere between $500 to $1,200. You know, it probably started at like $12. We even had to pay to get our names on the marquee.
Wow.
And the pricing went down to like the last show. They gave us the marquee and everything alone for $500 because they knew we were drawing 400 people. And, you know, the downstairs, you know, old dingy boxing room known as the Silver Nugget. So Chrissy lost her job somehow, whatever. She became the entertainment director at the Casablanca at Mesquite. So somehow we were talking and I was like, hey, what about doing a show here? And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, that'd be cool, blah, blah, blah. We talked about, you know, they would actually pay us to run a show, which is the first time that would ever happen for us. So then they brought up the idea like, hey, one of the bosses was, thankfully was a big wrestling fan. He was like, oh, you know, what about Hulk Hogan? Can we get Hulk Hogan to come down? And I'm like, you know, he's going to be a lot of money, whatever. But, you know, I put the work in. Nobody's ever going to outwork me is my number one statement. So I ended up finally getting in touch with Hulk Hogan's agent, and he wanted $40,000.
Wow.
For 2 hours. And I'm like, you do know if you charge like $100 an autograph, you would need like 5 hours for him to have constant business to sign to get your money back. So we had talked about, because at that point we had used Paul London and Brian Kendrick. Or we had used Brian Kendrick before, I believe. And we had used Eugene, who was actually the first defense for Alcatraz at Sam's Town.
Right.
So we got to talking and I gave them a list of people. And they were going to pay for everything, okay? So through one connection, because John Morrison, when he was getting ready for Tough Enough, beforehand he did some training, and Mike Modest was the guy who trained him. You know, just basic stuff. But John always remembers Modest. So I remember calling John up, and we were talking, and he was like, wanted a good amount of money. And now we talked, and Disco Inferno was still friends with Kevin Nash. He gave Kevin the phone number. Kevin calls me up, and then he tells me he wants $5,000. Okay. And I guess I didn't hear the part about first class flight because he's 6'9", you know. So everything's set up. I send all the info. They want Kevin Nash. They want John Morrison. We got Paul London, Brian Kendrick. We got Eugene on the show. We have The Godfather. Well, maybe The Godfather was on the second show. But either way, we had, you know, a shit ton of talent and called the show When Stars Collide. And I believe the total bill was about $16,000 or $17,000.
Oh, wow. Not bad.
That Mesquite ended up paying for it. We did pretty well. We probably drew $400 or $500, but they made money because I guess a few high rollers out of Utah helicoptered in for the event because they wanted to meet Kevin Nash. So it was a win-win for everybody. So we had set it up, and it was Tyshawn Prince, because you want to reward the guys that have put out for you. Because again, in most cases, especially for the local talent, it isn't about the money. It's about getting the experience, getting to work people, making connections and all that. And, you know, even though Kevin Nash was up there and not doing as much as he used to, just being in the ring, I remember being it so surreal sitting at the commentating booth because Nash did a promo to basically set everything up. And he comes walking out with an FSW T-shirt. And it's like, holy shit, you know, because I grew up, you know, the NWO, that was the shit, you know, and it's like Kevin Nash is walking into my ring with my shirt on. It's like, you know, as a wrestling fan, how surreal is that?
That's amazing.
Yeah, and the match was all right, but it was more of the nostalgia, you know, the setup. He got the power, you know, Tyshawn looked strong. You know, Kevin made sure that Tyshawn looked like the champion that he was. We had the underlings of Sally's group, the Dynasty. I remember like Saiku and a few others taking the power bombs. And, you know, Kevin Nash got out of there. And, you know, It was a great moment, and it was also the first sign of seeing what bringing in huge names can do to the company. You know, locally we were doing great. Everybody was getting behind the young stars, but you know, to try to get new fans, you need something that's going to click to make them want to come, because again, it's bad enough for another wrestling company in, you know, Montana, but in Vegas, where there's a million things to do, why are they going to set aside for a family of four $150 to come to a wrestling show with guys on flyers that they have no idea who they are?
Yeah. And that brings us to this time period after Remy drops it to Tyshawn. It goes back and forth between Tyshawn and Alcatraz until finally we get another name, like you were just talking about, in Matt Hardy. What brought about the transitioning between Tyshawn and Alcatraz, and what eventually gets you to bringing in Matt?
Well, actually, Matt was brought into the company for one of the Mesquite shows. So we're going to have Matt Hardy wrestle Bryce Harrison for the No Limits title at When Stars Collide 2. And we're talking, and initially the idea is we're going to have Bryce go over. Ooh. You know, pin him. Yeah. You know, I'm not worried. I know a lot of these, the big name guys, they don't want to put people over. But unless somebody told me specifically, like, I figured a Kevin Nash is not going to take a clean pin against Tyshawn Prince.
Right.
Okay. Matt Hardy, he was bouncing around a bit, and it was done with TNA. And I forgot how I got his number through somebody. It might have been the Godfather. I'm not even sure. But I finally got in touch with him. I tried a few different times. He finally called me back. We set it up. We agreed on the price, and I was a little surprised. It was way less than John Morrison and Kevin Nash. And he wrestled Bryce. We also had his wife, Rebby, on the show. She wrestled Shelly Martinez, which to this day is the most watched match in our YouTube history. Okay, so we do the setup, and Bryce comes up to me, and I thought it was Matt at first, but it seems like Bryce felt that he didn't earn that victory, so they were going to do some kind of schmoz. And I'm like, okay, you know, whatever's necessary, we're going to do that, which, again, ended up being the right move. After the match, Brandon Gatson, who had won the Cash in the Case ladder match that night, came in. I don't even know if he won it that night. I believe he did. And then he ended up cashing in after Matt Hardy laid out Bryce with the Twist of Fate. So Gatson got the rub, and him, Rebby, and Matt were in the middle of the ring. It got a good pop. It probably would have got a better pop in Vegas because, again, there was fans. And there was a good amount of fans from that area, St. George or whatever, but they didn't really know the product. They were just there to watch the show.
Right.
And, you know, at that point, I had, through Scott Hosey over at Power Play, I had Matt a gig to do a signing there the next day. And for the first time, you know, Scott had like a line out the door. You know, to where, you know, a lot of times he'll get some people to come by, but, you know, he'll also sell the 8x10s online, autographs, whatever. But Matt Hardy was like pure profit before, you know, half the things were sold. And, you know, he's only selling $25, $20 for an autographed picture. But there were so many people that were excited to come see Matt Hardy. Now, remember, in Mesquite, we had the meet and greet. So that means it was all the people from Vegas who didn't come.
Right.
So it was like, hey, Matt, since your rate's really good and stuff, love to have you come and work in Las Vegas. So we ended up bringing Matt in, and he tag teamed with Kenny King, if I remember correctly. And I believe he wrestled Robbie E and somebody else. Huh. I couldn't remember who the other guy was, but it was a tag match. Because at that point, there was this guy, Johnny Ferrari, this poker guy, who claimed he was a professional poker player. And he would bring those guys in to do shoots for his little segments and shit that was horrendous. But he paid those guys and flew them in and all this other stuff. So we had Robbie, and like I said, the other guy, I don't know who it was, but that was the first time we had Matt Hardy. Might have been Brian Cage, to be honest with you. And we said, wow, you know, the turnout was great. People were interested in Matt Hardy. You know, here's a guy. I remember we went to go eat lunch at a place called The King and I off Trop in Maryland, where actually it was one of the first places me and the wife used to go when we had our we had the reception at our house. They actually catered the food.
Okay.
So that was a place where we'd always go to eat. So me and Matt were talking, and he was all good with, you know, making FSW one of his frequent stops. And we put together a plan. At that point, we actually had another title called the Elite title that Kenny King beat Brian Cage for. So at that point, we did a title versus title match, and it was Alcatraz versus Kenny King. And Alcatraz defeated Kenny. The Elite title went wayside. And now Alcatraz is looking for somebody to defend the title against. And now we make the big announcement. Matt Hardy is wrestling for the FSW Heavyweight Championship. So, of course, ticket sales are very good. People are excited about it. But in most cases, when people see that big name guy coming to wrestle for the title, he's not going to win. They'll do whatever has to be done, and people will move on, and they get to see Matt Hardy.
Right.
Well, with the agreement that we had reached, and I knew we were going to be able to use him, we decided that this would be a great time to put the title on Matt Hardy. And again, the match is going back and forth, and the crowd's excited. But if you watch the video, when the referee hits three, there's almost like a hesitation, like they were stunned and couldn't believe that Matt Hardy really won. And then when they realize, oh shit, he did win, the crowd went crazy.
Wow.
And, you know, at that point now, that became, you know, the biggest moment in FSW history. Matt Hardy is now the heavyweight champion. And now Matt Hardy goes outside. Everybody wants to take a picture with him. He makes a video, and he treats his FSW Heavyweight Championship victory as if he just won the TLC match against the Dudleys and Edge and Christian. Like, you know, and this guy's got, you know, a couple of million Twitter followers, because Matt was the originator of getting social media interested in what he was doing.
Right.
And you know, he was the guy that, yeah, maybe we were the best kept secret in wrestling. Everybody knew us in Arizona and California, but now we started getting fans elsewhere because they were paying attention, because now the lineage of people that we're bringing through the doors is starting to be quite impressive. And, you know, Matt Hardy was the final straw that really helped put us over. It's like, I've discussed, and I told many people, that Matt Hardy, you know, helped make FSW what it is. And now we've continued to build on that. We could have stayed where we were and we would have still been doing wonderful.
Right.
But so much more has happened since because of the connections and all the other stuff. But Matt Hardy in, you know, 2014, you know, really made FSW, you know, it was our 5 years. Hey, that's a long time. 2014, 2009, 5 years. Wow, we're doing really well for ourselves. And now Matt Hardy is the heavyweight champion. And I believe his first title defense was against the winner of our show called Against All Odds. We've built up about three or four mainstay shows. The No Escape features the steel cage. Against All Odds is a 30, at the time 25, whatever, 30-man rumble where the winner gets the title match that night.
Yep.
So that's why it's called Against All Odds. So I think it fits really well. So, you know, you have to beat 30 guys. You have to beat 29, and then you have to beat the champion who's fresh in the main event. And at that point, we were down to three guys. It was Brian Cage, Tyshawn Prince, and Lance Hoyt, who we had worked with on a few occasions. And I was like, oh, Lance Hoyt is awesome. So they ended up throwing out Tyshawn, and Cage and Hoyt worked together, and Hoyt double, you know, whatchamacallit. He ended up out-tricking, I guess the word. That ain't even the word. Outmaneuvered Brian Cage, you know.
Double-crossing him, essentially.
Double-cross, yeah, double-cross. Thinking of Kevin Cross. He double-crossed Cage, and we ended up having Hoyt versus Hardy in the main event. And Matt went over again, and people were like, oh my God, you know, it's like, what's going on? Like, he's here again. And then we have him booked again. And then he ended up wrestling Brian Cage a few months later. And Brian Cage came oh so close. The referee was out. He tried to use the belt, but Matt showed a little heelism as Matt ended up grabbing the belt when the referee was down, and he clocked Cage with it and proceeded to beat him, which now drew some boos from the crowd. Okay. Well, we ended up setting something up, and Brian Cage. So I'm not sure which one came first. It might have been Cage first, then it might have been Hoyt, because after the match, so I'm assuming it had to be after the Hoyt match, Brian Cage laid out, or try to lay out Matt Hardy, brought in a table, and then we set up for the first ever FSW TLC match for the heavyweight championship. And that match had huge buildup. Matt Hardy got on the mic, put it over as the match he created, and he's going to take out Brian Cage once and for all. And we ended up having, to this day, the biggest crowd we ever had in Sam's Town history. It was legit standing room only, almost 1,000 people in there. You know, we did really well at No Escape this past year, and we came pretty close, but I'm pretty sure revenue-wise, because we did some specials with $10 tickets at No Escape and blah, blah, blah. But the setup for that, and then Cage, you know, went over, and he became the newest FSW heavyweight champion, where he was a guy that we first used. It was either the first Silver Nugget show in 2000, and I believe it was. I believe we brought in Brian Cage in 2009, and he ended up having what we ended up awarding the match of the year against Brandon Gatson at the Silver Nugget. And it took Brian, you know, a few years to get acclimated with FSW to where he became, you know, a fixture, and then he got the build up. And now Brian Cage became the man in FSW.
What did you see in Brian that made you think that he was someone that would be a draw that fans would gravitate to?
Well, it was funny because when we brought in Cage in 2010, it's like, oh, man, this dude's big.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, I didn't bring him back maybe for 6-8 months. It's like, oh, shit, Cage is a lot bigger. And then it would be like, and then we'd bring him back and it'd be like, shit, he's bigger again. And it was crazy because, like, every 4 months or so when we would first bring him in, it'd be like, he's bigger again, he's bigger again. And then probably in that 2013 or so, 2012, we started really using him regularly. We used him in a tag team because he was a tag team in Hollywood with Sean Ricker. And, you know, they worked together. And Cage became the mainstay, and then he became the guy that we felt, you know, genetically he was in better shape than anybody you ever saw. But he also wrestled like he was a cruiserweight X division guy doing all this insane stuff.
Right.
So technically, here's a guy who does all this cool shit that people are like, oh my goodness. But he's also a powerhouse who looks like $1 million. You know, that's a guy that has star written all over him.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And obviously we've seen where he's gone. And it's amazing too with the AEW rumors that Brian said it there. And then you got Lance and you got Matt.
Rumors, that's right.
Yeah, I'll keep it at that, rumors. But the fact of the matter is that here's three guys that are like the hottest coming into AEW. And you had them all at that time, you know, simultaneously. It's amazing. It's like that just goes to show, you know, 6 years ago, you were ahead of the curve.
10 years ago, I was ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
I had Brian Cage in 2009, you know? And realistically, I'm a pretty humble guy, but I have no problem, as you know, speaking as truthfully as possible. And I also know what my strengths are. And I always felt that I had a great eye for talent.
Right.
That's why the Young Bucks were on my very first show. I didn't know him. I had no idea. I've never seen him live. I went through things and it was like, wow, these guys look pretty impressive. And it was the same thing with Ricker. It was the same thing with Cage. When you saw Kevin Cross, when you saw Hammerstone, Chris Bay, you knew there was something special about him.
Right.
You know, and I always felt that I had a good eye for talent and being able to put them in a situation, because I always hear the thing that, you know, Paul Heyman would always used to say was, you know, accentuate the strengths and hide the weaknesses. Rob Van Dam wasn't great on the microphone. So in ECW, they played up to his immense athletic ability and didn't let him bury himself on a microphone.
Right.
And it's like nowadays you see where hey, Shorty Gable. Like, you're destining this guy to fail.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, I don't understand. And, you know, as we're looking for the championship guy, because, you know, it's wrestling. Oh, yeah, he didn't win the title. He was given the title. Well, he was given the title because he was the guy most deserving. So he really did win the title. He proved that he's the guy that should be in that position because of the way he exhibits himself inside and outside of the ring.
Yeah. Yeah. That's absolutely true. And I think that there's, you know, just looking at the history there, that's like the biggest thing you gather from this is that all of these guys carried themselves outside of the ring just as well as they delivered inside the ring. What we're going to do is kind of do a wrap up here and leave it off with Brian, and we'll continue next week for the last 5 years from 2015 to today. And a couple things before we go. With the championship belt, who designed the belt?
I designed it. But it was help from people coming up with the logo, the guy who made the belt. And it was like, hey, this is what I want. This is what I'm looking for. You know, I'm pretty sure Owen wasn't involved with that yet because he was involved with the Mecca. And we kind of did that. But on the FSW Heavyweight Championship belt, I gave them an idea. I saw a design I liked and it was tweaked from that. So I think it was Top Rope Belts, but I kind of, you know, I have no skill in art, but I kind of gave them the idea of what he wanted. He would send me some stuff and I'd be, yeah, I like it with this. Well, maybe the star should go here. And then, so I guess technically I designed it.
Okay. That works. 'Cause it's a gorgeous belt. And that's why I was just wondering if there was, you know, someone who came up with the concept, and it's just a beautiful belt. And, I encourage everyone who hasn't come to an FSW show, as soon as they start running again, come on out, because,
oh, but did you see the Mecha belt? Yo?
Well, see, yeah, that's the thing. The Mecha belt. Yes. But, you know, just in terms of, the history of this title and just, you know, where it came from. And I think, you know, the design itself was a great little design. Really quick, I'm going to do something I call real intelligent booking. And I just want to just pick your brain for about three different questions. In that first period between the Kenny King and up to Matt Hardy, what was your favorite title match in those first 5 years?
You know, to be honest with you, the very first match with Kenny, you know, I didn't think it was anything special, but again, it was the first show we did. So it's kind of hard, you know, to say. I know for a fact that the Matt Hardy, Brian Cage, TLC match was by far the biggest match we ever had.
Right.
Now, you know, I can't really go back and say, hey, technically this one was good or this one got that much heat. You know, Disco and Kenny King got a lot of heat. You know what I mean? Back then.
Yeah.
But for everything that we did moving forward, probably my favorite match was the first steel cage match with Tyshawn and Alcatraz. That really set the bar. That really put all our other title matches. Yeah, they may have been good and stuff, but this was a crazy gimmick match in front of a huge crowd that was on the edge of their seat for the entire match. And it was brutal. Those guys pulled out all the stops, and, you know, to this day, it might be, you know, if you ask Alcatraz, and he's wrestled in Japan, he's wrestled all over the world, that might be his favorite match he's ever had.
And as far as that time period, is there one person that you can think of that you think that you should have maybe put the belt on or would have liked to put the belt on, but ended up not putting the belt onto them?
Well, looking back in the day, there was always talk of Funny Bone becoming the champion. He was extremely popular. You know, he would do crazy stuff, but it always just seemed to not hit at the right spot. You know, he did win the No Limits title, and he did a great job with that. And to this day, he's still one of the most exciting guys that we have on the roster.
Right.
And if I look back at someone who I say, wow, like, you know, you go back, you can look at WWE and it's like, I can't believe Jake the Snake or Million Dollar Man never won the title.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Nowadays, 100 guys win the titles. But with FSW, we really wanted to make that championship mean something. So Kenny had the title for almost a year. Tyshawn had the title for like a year. Kevin Cross held the title forever. Hammerstone. The only time was when Ricker was leaving, so we did three title changes within 6 weeks.
Yeah.
You know? And to me, the most valuable asset you have is is your heavyweight championship.
Right.
So since we tried to space it out as much as we did, you know, it was extremely important, so it was hard. So when we think a guy like Funny Bone is a guy who could be the champion, he could be the champion.
Right.
And the way things write themselves, it just never manifested. It just didn't happen. And it's no reasoning, nobody's fault. It's just moving forward. It's the same thing with some of the No Limits guys. Guys weren't expected to win the belt. We felt they were hot at a certain time. We felt doing the change would work. And even though somebody might not, you know, we can delve into that another time, the No Limits division.
Yeah.
And because that's been the most, you know, the most change to where people that we didn't expect to be the champion, I felt they deserved it. And, you know, you work hard and you put the time in and you make FSW a priority. The goal is to reward people, you know, however you can, you know what I mean? And, you know, thinking back of all the guys that have held titles and things like that, and I couldn't even tell you that, yeah, you know, we were 99% sure Funny Bone was going to get it, but because of this, it was more like, yeah, if there was a guy who could have had a little bit of a run. You know, he was involved in some championship matches that, you know, probably were decided within the last week or so before the show whether he would win it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good choice. The final question I have is kind of related to that, and that is, you have someone who is smart and talented in Sin Bodhi. How come Sin has never been champion?
Well, Sin Bodhi has a lot on his table, and Sin Bodhi is more of a part-time wrestler in FSW. As one of our main trainers, you know, he's there, but on the weekends, he's making very good money on the road. So what we would pay him compared to what he's going to make elsewhere, and since we're trying to be future stars of wrestling, because if you look at our last five or six champions, they're mostly guys that were, you know, with us from the beginning, but they were kind of newer, you know, Hammerstone, it was like, okay, it was his time. Cross, it was his time. Bay, it was his time. Those guys, and some had been doing it for 2 or 3 years, some were doing it for 5, but they were still relatively young in the business. You know, Sin Bodhi's had his run in TNA, he's had his run, you know, in WWE. He's a trainer for the developmental down at NXT. So his time, and that's why you don't see him on a lot of shows. If you see a show and Sin Bodhi's not on it, it's not because we didn't want to book him, it was because he was booked elsewhere.
So basically, you're getting at the fact that Sin is an old man now.
Oh, he is without a doubt. But, you know, he's in great shape for the old guy that he is.
Well, then I think we got to push you to put the belt on Sin.
Well, I guess if the old timers want to go with an old guy, I guess so.
So next week, we're going to just kind of finish the 5 years between 2015 and now. If anyone listening has any questions, please feel free to reach out to us on social media or email us at vegasbadboysofpodcasting@gmail.com. That's bad boys with a Z. I would love to have Joe answer, you know, any questions that you have about the championship and about some of the wrestlers who have been FSW champion. Feel free to, you know, ask these questions now, because Joe will, you know, go into detail and really give you honest answers, and that's what we're here for, because the truth is here with the DeFalco Files. Joe, it's been great. Can't wait to talk to you.
And if I can,
yes,
as I talked with you yesterday, I was talking to one of the best under the radar trainers in wrestling, Tom Howard.
Yep.
And we're trying to see, hopefully next week we can have an announcement. We'd love to have you guys help us put it together. But doing a podcast with Tom, who was the trainer at UPW and trained John Cena and Samoa Joe. And he's interested. I'm interested. We've been talking about doing a podcast for a long time. So it's like, you know, now is the time. And hopefully in the next week we can get it together and then get it rolling.
And that sounds amazing. And if you guys don't know who Tom Howard is, and I think I probably have brought him up quite a few times over the last year, because Tom was one of my trainers at UPW. And you look at...
You won't admit that one, though.
No, of course not. No, he shouldn't even remember who I am, you know. But I'll tell you, in terms of knowledge and teaching and stories, you put Joe DeFalco and Tom Howard, you know, together, and man, I think we can cover about 30 to 40 years of wrestling history.
We could break the record for the longest podcast in one day.
Yeah.
You know, and for our FSW fans, you know, Tom has gotten back into the field because he is the trainer of the FSW women's champion, Lacey Ryan.
Yep. Yep. And if you see a match from Lacey, especially the match she did with Tessa
before. Well, we're going to hopefully air that today on YouTube. We're trying to get it uploaded, and we're going to, from the Mecca 6, we're hoping that match is going to be ready to roll. So if it isn't today, it should be by tomorrow. But that match, the full match, will be there. And you can also check out Lacey's match with Jordan Grace on Impact. So she's really tremendous.
Yep, she knows. And this is what I give Tom all the credit for, in terms of he teaches you how to lay a match out, what the psychology is, and he knows what your strengths and what your weaknesses are, and knows how to help you kind of, you know, incorporate those strengths, hide the weaknesses, and tell an amazing story. And that's what, you know, he brings to the table as a trainer. And
Lacey. Yeah, like every time I see him, I pick his brain, and in a 5-minute conversation, like we were at Sam's Town watching the Impact, a 5-minute conversation, that'll be in 35 minutes.
Yep. Yeah. So hopefully we'll have an official announcement for you guys next week, and we'll definitely, you know, bring you guys quality, because that's what we're looking to do. And Joe DeFalco brings nothing but quality to his wrestling shows. So coronavirus, get the fuck out of here. Let's go away and let's get back to some good wrestling here in Las Vegas.
Get it going.
And remember, check out Future Stars Wrestling. Go to the website. You can follow him on social media, and you can look up Joe on Facebook. You know, and follow everything that's going on with him. And we really appreciate everything that you bring to the table, Joe. And we'll talk to you next week. Until then, everyone, take care.